This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi guys, welcome to Adulting. This is the podcast where I try to figure out all the things that we're supposed to know as grown-ups, but apparently don't know. And one of the biggest parts of growing up is realizing your privilege. I came across an amazing account on Instagram called No White Saviors, and it really opened up my eyes to deeper, further understanding of the nuances towards white privilege, racism, and white saviorism, which is something we're going to be talking about today. So I am joined by Bruce.
Hi.
And I'm also joined by Kelsey.
Hi guys.
So these guys, do you want to say a little bit about yourselves, introduce your background, etc.?
Sure. Bruce, you want to go first?
Well, Kelsey, you go first. Ladies first. Go ahead.
We're just so selfless. I am a social worker by degree. I got just finished my master's. Prior to that, had been living in East Africa for about 4 years altogether. I lived in Uganda, in Jinja specifically. Yeah, just that. That's basically my background. Social worker, worked in East Africa in child welfare. Thought for a while that I was above the savior complex. Thought that, you know, because we had Ugandan leadership in our organization, because we didn't take a front and center role in serving the needs of the clients that came through our program. I thought, okay, like I'm evolved, I'm conscious, I woke, so to say. But in coming back to the US and in doing my master's and in following accounts like Layla and Rachel Cargill and just really digging much deeper into my privilege and into racism and white supremacy, realize like there's so much that like I didn't address and that I that even in the moments when I was living there that I thought I knew and I still had so wrong. I think that was the motivation. I actually was the one who started the account initially, but it sat for No White Savior sat for quite a few weeks kind of dormant because I didn't want to be a white person running that account without the voices of East Africans specifically, because that was my context and that's what I knew. So the other three women running it alongside of me that are okay with their names and identities being known, they are all women that I've known through living there. So Priscilla was actually my lawyer.
Oh, really?
She was my lawyer when we needed a lawyer. We were running into some issues. She knew about what our organization in Jinja was doing. She actually volunteered to help us like at a very low cost. Yeah. So right off the bat, knew she was someone who, you know, like you come across your people and you're about the things that I like care about. And so Priscilla and I have been connected ever since then. And then Olivia actually was one of the social workers at the project that I co-founded in Uganda. And we've always been friends since like we worked together. But I think even since starting this account, there's been some unpacking there where I have said, Olivia, I'm sure there are ways that my power dynamic was not addressed even in like our working relationship and our friendship. And I want you to feel like you can talk through those things with me, but that could be a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
Sharon is someone I admire a great deal. She runs a whole project herself in Jinja. She actually grew up in an orphanage herself in Jinja, Uganda. So she's been both the recipient of the white savior complex. Like she has seen growing up, having white people come in and out of the orphanage she grew up in, and having white folks come in and out of this town and form relationships and then leave, and then the way that they portray her and other Ugandans. So I think we all, the team of the women, we it's interesting because we all know each other very well. Then we have another team member. I'll call her G. That's the first letter of her name, but she just, because she's still working in development, she does not wish to be identified. Just like Bruce is going by an alias. So that's a good segue. Bruce is also new to us. He is our only guy on the team, but he is like, he's a feminist. He might not tell you that, but I think might even be part of his intro, but he is like, so he's aware, as a male too. So that's really awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for introing me. And part of the reason why I'm going about it this way is because the team, I love how the team has established itself. And you typically, because of the systems of patriarchy, you don't see as many women-led organizations or movements because of patriarchy. So I don't want my voice, because typically that's what will happen is, oh, because a male person is speaking, then things will be legitimized for whatever reason. So I'm trying to walk that balance. And that's why, because this wonderful women have started this organization, this movement, I am fully supporting this movement and lending my whatever expertise I have. But I want to acknowledge and it continue to be an organization led by women.
Right.
I think that's important. And that's what I know. Kelsey will resist that, you know, but I believe, I think that for me, I feel we don't have enough of that anyway. So, you know, so that's my first, my little thing there. So my history is very brief. I was born and raised in Kenya and went to the U.S. for college, and I've lived in the U.S. in general for about over 20 years, but I've also been blessed to travel all over Europe and parts of Southeast Asia and Australia and New Zealand. And so I've been able to see different experiences and experience different cultures and see the commonalities we have as human beings, and also the various disparities that exist. And so my own coming into this space was experiencing prejudice as an African, as a Kenyan, and as a Black person in America. So this intersectionality within all those experiences, and then seeing the disparities that other people experience, you know, whether it's the GLBTQIA community, you know, the indigenous communities, you know, Black folks, you know, Latinos, Native Americans, you know, mixed race, you know, so all, you know, being able to see all of that woke me, if you want to say that, use that term. And this is where it brought me to, you know, to where I am today. And I've, you know, I've been involved in architecture and sustainability. Mm-hmm. That's where my career level is. But in terms of how I came into No White Saviors, is they reached out to me, I guess, because of my crazy commentary sometimes on Instagram. And we bonded, Kelsey and I bonded, and I loved their page. It was just like, it was speaking to a lot of the things that I had in my mind.
Yeah.
And so, and this is where we are at now.
Well, one question before we go anywhere. What do you think about white people using the term woke? I actually used it in a post the other day, and I know that it comes from like African-American vernacular English. Is that how you say it? AA?
Yes.
So how do you feel about white people? Do you think that's an appropriation of the term if we use it to mean, because there's no real other word that we have in the English language that means like socially conscious aware in the same way?
Yeah. So for me, the way I've understood woke to be is especially referencing whether it's white folk or anything, is like, it's someone who is aware of the disparities that exist and acknowledges them and is an ally to Black and Indigenous people of color in terms of challenging, you know, white supremacy and systems of systemic racism. So that's where from my understanding, where the word woke is, oh, this person is woke, they are aware.
Yeah.
And so it's a term that can be used appropriately, but then obviously because it's always fashionable to take a term and then use it with everything, you yeah. know, in every sense, just like when, you know, the fist pounding that came from sports, from Black folk, and now everyone, you see CEOs doing it the same, it's going towards appropriation. It's leading towards everyone using it for everything. It's being yes. watered down.
Yeah.
So I think, again, it's context. It's, if you're using it in the proper context, I think it's fine. But if it's become almost a playful or like a jokey way of like, oh, yeah, so, you know, like yeah. you can...
It's being, I think it's where, having that awareness of where the heritage of the word is from, or like...
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. And yes, it does veer towards inappropriateness in terms of how it's used, you know, if it's not, if it's, because it's a serious, I think it's a serious term.
Yeah.
You know, it is a serious, it means something deep and serious. And so, you know, when it becomes very playful to an extreme extent and very arbitrary, then, as you stated, you know, it can become inappropriate to use.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Yeah, so... How did you come about? Did you, like, were you just on Instagram and then you found the page? How did that happen?
So I follow a really cool, like, artist activist called Florence Given, who's yes. really engaged, and she shares loads of really cool pages. So I'm always, like, following her stuff. And then I came across No White Saviors and I just got engrossed and, like, yeah. obsessed with everything that you're writing. Yeah. And I was like, that's really helpful. And I wanted to reply to everyone. And I was like, oh, this isn't my place. Because, like, it's only, like, in the last few years that I've really started to understand, like, the point of privilege that I have, and then I've kind of got really into it, but to hear different perspectives, like the more you get into it, you're like, shit, you just can't stop seeing it everywhere. Could you just briefly, like, could you define what a white savior is? Because I'm not even joking, I subconsciously was aware of the idea, but when I went on the page, I was like, oh my god, obviously this is so ridiculous that we go over there, take a few pictures and come back, and we're like, we've done such a good deed. Of course it's not about the people you're helping, it's ultimately, it's just helping the volunteer. But how do you define, like, what a white savior is, and what's the feeling in these countries that are being helped? Like, how are we, as, like, westernized countries, like, looking in from completely the wrong angle?
Yeah, Kelsey, do you want to go first?
Sure. So I think much like institutionalized racism. Or institutionalized white supremacy, right? We're not looking at it as much like the one-on-one, the like individual, like if I want to like capture what that means, that's just a symptom.
Yeah.
The larger problem is the narrative and the rhetoric that has been used to talk about countries in the Southern Hemisphere, and for what we're talking about specifically in sub-Saharan Africa. So, you know, that looks like things like, you know, colonization, drawing borders around it, like dividing tribes and people groups and putting tribes and people groups that did not maybe get along or wouldn't have been put together otherwise. And then us, you know, in 2018, criticizing African countries for still having, you know, conflict.
Right.
So that's that systemic nature of, oh, like, why can't you just get your act together?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, again, and that's only one part. So when I guess when I look at the white savior complex, I think all of the thing, it is built upon all of these preconceived notions and lies that we have, that Africa is less resourceful, less knowledgeable, less able, less capable, and that we, because we are Western and therefore we are superior. So it's white supremacy.
Yeah.
And I know that is a very strong term for a lot of people. That's why, I don't know, do you follow Layla?
Yeah, I do, but I don't that closely. But, and also Rachel Carg, I've only just recently yeah. started following her, but she's amazing.
Yeah, both of them, I think, if we can link your followers and the listeners to those two accounts, I would say both Layla's in the UK and Rachel's here in the US in New York. I actually work with Rachel closely. I help moderate a group for called The Start. And so I've worked with Rachel closely one-on-one, and she and Layla both, and there's other, so many other powerful Black women doing important work. But I think Layla specifically, I've seen identify white supremacy in a way that is accessible, but not gentle. And I think that's really, really important. That for too long, when we talk about white supremacy, it's been, well, I'm not a Nazi.
Yes.
Or I'm not a fascist. I'm not all of these things. And we're talking about a larger system, just right. Like, I'm not going to come and say like all white saviors, you're all racist and terrible. Well, we're all contributing to racism,
this
right?
We're
adding to that problem.
So I get this backlash a lot when I talk about white privilege and racism. And I'm like, you might not be a functioning active racist who's going around saying things, but by proxy of being white, you profit off of structures that destabilize Black and ethnic minority groups, because in order for you to keep your privilege, you have to be standing on someone. So whether or not you're actively acting in a racist manner, you are also a product of what you're not doing. So unless you're working to destabilize these structures that keep these racist structures working, then you are a little bit racist. And I know people get so offended, because I don't mean you personally individually, I just mean we. And also, you don't have to be white either. This is the other thing. Like, people can be, just like a woman could be a misogynist, a person of color can be racist. It's structures, and it just depends where you're born, how you profit off them.
Yeah.
I think everyone takes it much too individually. It's not about the individual. Mm. I mean, it is, but fundamentally, it's about really unpicking the structures that were there already.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's really well said.
Yeah. And just piggybacking on what Kelsey was saying, you know, and I mispronounce his name. Is it Rudyard or Rudyard Kipling?
Rudyard. I say Rudyard, but I don't know, actually.
Yeah. So he wrote this poem, you know, The White Man's Burden. In 1899, and was a reference, I think, to the American-Filipino War. Well, basically, it really was taking up that mantle of, you know, white man's burden to take care of others who were savages.
Mm.
And that was also what was carried on in terms of colonialism. So that mentality has continued. We say post-colonialism, but it's continued beyond that to this point today. So you go from, colonizing all these Southern Hemisphere nations, Africa and all, you know, Africa, Southeast Asia and so forth, to civilize, and I put that in quotes, to civilize the savages, which is it's a stupid, stupid idea that doesn't even exist. And then post-colonial, when all these countries, African countries, are only about, on average, 50 to 60 years old in terms of independence. So they're beginning the process of just being independent and growing and learning about themselves, especially when they've been thrown together forcibly by these colonial powers, which were European. And then, so that's happening. And then you have all these multinational institutions, corporations, these trade agreements between the Western world or Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere countries that are imbalanced. White privilege has existed for a long time, since the first explorers went out to explore the Americas, and, you know, the Portuguese and the Spanish, and then it spread out in terms of into colonialism and to what we have today with institutions set up that create that benefit, explicit and implicit, in terms of, for white folk. And again, it's not, like you said, you know, you're born into the system, you might not be aware of it until it's brought, you know, until you study and see where those disparities are. Just like, you know, it's a patriarchy. The world is a patriarchy. Men benefit way more than women do. I acknowledge that as a man. I know I have had so many benefits. I know I don't have to fear about walking out at night and fear about being assaulted or any of those things that women have to experience. I there's so many things that I have privilege as a man that women don't. And I can't pretend and be like, blah, 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 it's there. And so my responsibility is to recognize my privilege and to be an ally and to break the disparities that exist as a man towards women and other genders.
Yeah, I think you're able to see that, though, because as a man of color, you face your own fight.
Yes.
So I think that's why even like as a woman as well, I can see racism differently because I face sexism. It's the same with you. You face racism and then so you can understand sexism. I think the problem is, and also exactly what you're saying, no one's educated. In the UK, we're not taught about like black slave history in the UK. That's not on our school syllabus. There's an amazing book, you've probably read it, Why I'm No Longer Speaking to White People About Race by Rennie Oda Lodge. It's an amazing, have you guys read it?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a good book. So that's the first kind of time that anything properly published that's gone really wide has actually talked about British black slave history. Like before that, you get to talk about stuff that's completely irrelevant, like Egyptians and Tudors, which just doesn't add into your understanding of who you are in terms of us how society works. So that's recent history that we really should be taught about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just missing.
And I mean, my younger brother lives in London. And he's married and has a 2-year-old, and his wife is English and white. So I'm sure, we've never really talked about it, but I'm sure they have their experiences in terms of being an interracial couple and having a child that, is mixed, and for him being black, I'm sure, if I did ask him about that, which I will eventually, what those experiences are. And I've been to London, and I, like you're right, the UK and a lot of, whether it's France, Italy and all, with populations, with African or immigrant populations that are sizable enough, I think those conversations only come up when it's immigration issues or when it's to do with loss of jobs or economically.
Yes.
That's when you have those conversations or those things spring up. But in terms of dealing with the social, cultural, systemic issues, I think the U.S. is ahead in that sense.
Mm.
And I'm not saying it, oh, wow, they're ahead. No, it's just like it's us, it's black folk here in America have pushed and fought and clawed to be heard and continue to do so under the craziest circumstances.
I think it's a broader conversation in America. I think it's just less spoken about in the UK.
Yeah. But I think it's emboldening. I think look at your podcast, this podcast here, you're having this conversation. I think people, especially since we're a more connected world, I think these conversations are beginning to happen, whether it's talking about this particular subject of white privilege and systemic racism, whether it's talking about gender disparities, the Me Too campaign, Time's Up, all these things are now coming to the forefront. And hopefully this is just the beginning in terms of we have to have these painful conversations and painful emotions come out, and we have to face them. You can't soft pedal any of these conversations.
No.
Yeah.
So from that, could you explain to me, one, what drove you to set up No White Saviors, and two, to people who maybe still aren't grappling what the actual concept or what it is, and why it can be so damaging to these to communities, cultures, and countries when someone goes over and just tries to like kind of put their help in inverted commas onto people.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, this is something that I didn't realize. I started to realize it's as pervasive as I thought it might be when I started coming back and having conversations with other people who had traveled and spent time elsewhere and meeting people just from different countries like Nigeria, Ghana, Cameroon. I've had some women in my program from West Africa in university. So I think what drove me to start the account was all of the stuff I saw myself and so many others in my town of Jinja, Uganda, complicit in. And it went not only did it go a lot of times unchallenged, it was weirdly like amplified and supported and encouraged. Mm. Like, it wasn't even just that, like, oh, this, like, stuff is crazy as, and we posted this on the account, but there's a woman who was homeschooled in Virginia. A lot of it, it's not only, but a lot of it is very rooted in like Christianity. And yeah. I grew up in the evangelical church, in a predominantly white evangelical church. So I feel like I can also speak to that, is that there's this essence of like, God calls you and you don't actually have to know what you're doing. You just go and do it. And God's going to like make it happen. It's like some like weird, like, if you just go do it, all things are going to fall into place and God's going to just like make it work, instead of realizing like how effed up that is.
Yeah.
And realizing how problematic that is. People use God or religion or Jesus to excuse their irresponsibility.
And
helplessness. And so, again, I want to stress that I know it's not just a problem of evangelicals, but in the U.S. evangelical church, I think especially, but I've met evangelicals from Australia, from the U.K., from all over, from Germany, that are in Uganda and in other countries. So it's, yeah, I think, again, it's so many things wrapped up in one, but that saviorism is, we can go and fix problems that we actually don't know how to fix, that no one would ever let us fix or try to fix in our own country, because we don't have the degree, we don't have the training, we wouldn't be able to get the funding because no one would give us a grant to do it here. But we go overseas and do whatever the hell we want because we think that we can get away with it. And we have largely for a long time. And I think I know kids who have died at the hands of this. It's not just some selfies or some, you know, problematic content on a Facebook status. I've watched children die. Like the white one, I brought up this white woman from Virginia in the U.S., comes from evangelical family, was homeschooled, and she started a project to address malnutrition. She started with no medical training, doing blood transfusions and doing very serious, like physician-level medical care. No medical license. Children, when I tell you there was a nurse, there were multiple people from the U.S. and Uganda who reported what she was doing. There's tens to like at least like between like probably like 20 to 100 kids who have died because of her. And she was protected by the missionaries in our town. The white missionaries from the U.S. said we were attacking her. So we got her organization was shut down by the Ministry of Health because she wasn't registered to be a medical facility or wasn't registered properly. And she opened back up. She now opened up another project in Mayuge district in Uganda and is now still there. She should be facing criminal charges.
Right. Just to like contextualize this, in the UK, I genuinely think unless you're like first aid registered, you can't even like really put someone in the recovery position.
No.
So how are you then from going from that to going abroad to doing it's, you're so right. It's like no one would let you do this. And we really do. It's so selfish in of itself anyway, because I did it when I was 18. I went out to Ecuador. I spoke Spanish and I taught Spanish to indigenous children. And I remember thinking this was so great and it's amazing. But you're right. I waltzed into those kids' lives for like 2 months. They probably got really attached to me because they're really young. I absolutely loved them. And then I just left and went back home. And like, what happens when I go? Like, that's no stability for the child. Why do I think that I'm better than, why couldn't we have taught those Kichwa women and men Spanish to teach their own children or the child? That's where I think, it's so obvious now when you say it, but when it's done so much, it just seems like it makes sense. I mean, we have the whole comic relief where the whole idea of that is it's to support children in Africa. And it's like white celebrities go out and, you know, it's institutionalized. It's in our actual like almost government. Like, do you know what I mean? It's more than...
Well, I've flown
British Airways the most out of anyone.
Yeah.
And I would literally like cringe at the advertisements and the pamphlets that they put in for comic relief. I'm like, and actually one of my friends in Kampala that runs it's actually a very good charity. It's all mostly Ugandan led and it promotes, you know, kids being adopted domestically by Ugandan families. It's great.
Yeah.
But they were supported by comic relief. And I'm like, it's so exploitative the way that they, you know, with the language that was used, the graphics that are being used, you're like on your, you know, you're flying from Heathrow to Entebbe and you're like, this is like, you are just solidifying everything everyone already thought, you know, that was.
It's hard though, because I know that saying this, like obviously my listeners are mostly UK based. I know that'll hit a nerve and I know people will like, but it's so good. And the difficulty is that people see things like, but it's charity does good. That's what that's doing. But fundamentally, whilst it might seem like a great idea to go and to help someone less, like it's like exactly what you're saying. If someone was dying in the middle of the road, I wouldn't try and administer CPR or give them a blood transfusion. I would ring an ambulance. And it's like that on a very long extension. Instead of ringing an ambulance or locating people who know what they're doing within that area, we're going, oh, I'll just get on a plane and do it myself. Yeah. Like, I think that's the best way to kind of make it more.
Go ahead.
Can I clarify on the comic relief? Because I don't think they're complete trash. Right?
Yeah.
I don't want to ever throw away. There's most organizations I won't just say, don't like throw it away. Don't do anything. I think we all would agree. I don't want to speak for everyone, but we've talked a lot as a team about this. And it's not that we're saying don't do it at all. We're saying do it better.
Yeah.
You know, for comic relief, maybe one day it'll be us sitting at a boardroom table with them in London and saying, this is how we can improve your PR, because your PR, you're helping people, but at the same time, your heart hurting.
Yeah.
Because you're hurting the whole converse. You're continuing to solidify the language, the images, and the harmful just narrative overall of what has been said about these communities. And that's what we're trying to challenge. We're, you know, there is a way to talk about the need that exists and not paint people as weak and vulnerable and, you know, pitiful. There's ways to show the strength.
Yeah. And as you say, like, it's not that comic relief is bad. It's that is born out of a society that is still built off of these, like, especially as the UK, people don't realize we rape, pillage and stole from every other country in the world. We're like one of the worst people for invading everyone and taking everything. And then all of a sudden we're on our high horse, like, do you want us to help you? And I think that's just that little kind of bit of massive bit of hypocrisy needs to be addressed. So that you can see how actually this is such recent history that people just need a bit more awareness, I think. Bruce, what were you going to...
Those are really good points. And for me, looking at, historically, and I don't know about comic relief. I haven't heard about them, but I think the whole idea of charity should change. I think the word charity itself should be consigned to the basement or basin of whatever. It is a depowering term. I think the way organized, if you want to call it relief work, whatever you want to call it, I think it needs to change fundamentally, just like how any organization's businesses are changing how they do business. Relief organizations need to change as well. It's a co-creative aspect, and that's the thing. If you want, and that's really understanding why this exists and why you're going into this situation. And I think individually and organizationally, those questions need to be asked. And for myself, I posted in one of the No White Saviors Instagram before I even joined, Kelsey and the team. Like, for me, if I wanted to go and volunteer, what are some of the things, what would I look at myself and ask myself why I want to do them? So I'll just read quickly. Number one, it's take a step back and do some self-reflection on your motives. Like, really ask yourself why you're doing this. What is it? Where is this coming from? And why do you want to do this? And the second, you know, second point is it's co-creation, it's not versus charity. And that begins at home. Look at your local community, your town, and your city. There are deep issues of poverty and inequality in most towns and cities everywhere around the world. Start your advocacy work there and refine and learn from it. Basically, be a community activist. Yeah. So in other words, if you really want to be helpful, look around you, you know, like we tend to want to look outside of ourselves so much. And that narrative, like you spoke in the UK, and, you know, like the images of African children, you know, all these organizations, when they advertise calling for donations and they post these images of you know, dying babies and, you know, starving African children. And then you discover 50% or more of what is donated goes to administrative costs.
Yeah.
So that's the other aspect that, you know. And then the third thing I wanted to emphasize is to anyone who wants to do this has to educate themselves on the struggles of Black and Indigenous people of color and what they face in your community that you are in right now. And regionally and nationally as well. Learn about immigration and immigrant rights. Take workshops on all these issues, as well as take workshops on cultural sensitivity. And then another thing is to get out of your comfort zone in terms of learning about white privilege. You know, really ask yourself these questions. You know, read books and literature by Black and Indigenous people of color. You know, find out who these authors are, as well as African, Central American, South American, Caribbean, Polynesian, Southeast Asian authors. So learn, you know, start reading, because a lot of the books that we read are very, again, white-centered in that sense. So you have to teach yourself, you know, get involved in their communities, their immigrant communities around. Make some friends, get involved in, you know, come and see what, and be part, you know, witness their culture and just witness and observe and learn, you know. Talk to your family and white friends about white privilege. Educate yourself about colonialism, post-colonial policies, brinkmanship, the World Bank and IMF austerity policies towards the Southern Hemisphere, multinational corporations that abuse resources and the people of Southern, and exploit the people of the Southern Hemisphere as well. And the extreme imbalance in trade agreements between, you know, newly independent African and basically African countries and the Northern Hemisphere as well. Learn those things. Like, those are things you have to learn at first before you before I think you can think about, hey, I want to go to so and so country and, you know,
and save them
and volunteer. And then I think that's you know, and the idea again is a symbiotic process, you know. So, and there's local organizations in all these countries that are already doing great work. So rather than you going, unless you have a particular skill set, a really particular skill set that is lacking, or is there's a dearth of that skill set, and you feel through your training and you've done your orientation, you've done the research and so forth, that you can be of benefit to go and share that skill set, then that's fine. You can do that. But make sure you're thinking of it as a co-creative process, you know, and also, and then refrain from using any type of social media documentation. Do you have to respect the privacy?
I think that's
the people you're co-creating.
I think that's the part that really kind of struck home for me, is when you see it, when I see it on maybe someone's page, I'm like, oh, that's nice. But when you see it on your page and you see all these images of just people standing there with these communities, and you think, have those communities consented to be on this person's Instagram page? Do I even know that this, how do I know that those families aren't in a position that actually need help, and they happen to just be like, it's very exploitative. And and it's also the other part of thinking, like, we're so accustomed to how we live in our westernized nature and the way that our world works. Who are we to look in and say that actually those communities might be perfectly happy? They might be perfectly content and privileged within their own right. And it's that misinterpretation. It's that kind of like, oh, look at these people. When actually you have no idea what the standard of living is. You have no idea how happy they are. And you can't just kind of put that there and be like, look at me, this is so great. And I honestly didn't see it until you see it on your page. And it's so blindingly obvious how damaging that narrative is, that like we go in for 2 weeks. Yeah. Look, we saved everyone. Well, you didn't, you know?
I mean, I would love to. I mean, I've lived in the US for a while. I've traveled all over. I could go to one of the poorest communities anywhere here, you know, especially poor white communities.
Yeah.
And I could bring some donations and take pictures with the babies and the families. And post that. I could go to Leeds in the UK. I could go to, you know, Hampshire in England, and, you know, go to the, you know, and do the same thing. I could go anywhere. And you can imagine me doing something like that as a Black person, and then having the, you know, the furor, the hue and cry, the recriminations and all of that stuff. So for any person that's doing this, imagine me coming to your community, to your family, to your neighborhood, to even your house, and say, oh, there's a lower middle class. Oh, you're suffering. Okay, so you don't have, you know, I could take pictures and everything. Oh, your parents are fighting. Let me take pictures. You know, like I can go into, you're basically putting on blast in a reality show style situation people's lives. And so, and the excuse is, oh, we want to show what the struggle is. No, you don't need to do that in that way. That's poverty porn or whatever.
Yeah, and also because, like, I don't know what those communities live like normally. I don't know what their housing situation is like. I don't know what's deemed to be like a good family, a bad family, a good standard of living, etc. So when you're putting up these pictures, it's almost completely redundant and irrelevant, because obviously me living in London is a completely different lifestyle to someone living in Africa. So even the comparison in the first place is so extrapolated from our norm, it doesn't really make sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, we don't know what they're seeing or how their lives are. And you can't just be taking pictures of people. And it is, I think the thing is, it does come from a good intention, but it comes from a place where people need to be made to feel uncomfortable. And I know it can feel affronting, and it can feel a bit like, but I'm trying to help. I didn't do this to be cool. I didn't do this to be mean. But the point is, you're getting your kicks by thinking you're helping someone when there's, like, as you say, there's so many issues towards the way that our media represents immigration. When it's foreign people coming into the country, our media, you can count it on the TV. There might be like 20 stories in an hour, whether it's good or bad. We're told that foreign bodies coming into the UK is bad. But then the minute you want to do some help, you decide that you're going to go somewhere really far afield and help over there. And it's like, how can you have two completely opposing views towards people of the world? This is what's quite confusing. It's like we... Sorry, you kind of...
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. And I wanted to just bring one very interesting point, talking about Christian missionaries. And I'll speak specifically to the U.S., So we have our president, Trump, as our president. And he has a huge support from the evangelical right, the Christian right. And they were very much opposed to President Obama as the president, right? And President Obama, his heritage is half Kenyan, half African. So it's interesting that they were so opposed to how he was as a president, and yet you want to send missionaries to Africa. But it's not even, that's actually not even, it makes sense, because they're like, we want you to be in a position of charity, of wanting our help. But when you come into power, you are threatening to that very dynamic.
Completely. That's really sinister.
That's how I see it.
Yes,
we can interact with you as long as you aren't in the same level of privilege that we are.
Well,
so it's a very it's disingenuous in my, you know, you may have, you know, and I was raised Catholic. I read the Bible 3 times. I know it very well. And so and if we talk about Christian aspects, I can go another tangent and get people really angry. But my point is, it's very interesting how the way we choose to interact, and I'm saying we, but I'm saying the way we choose to interact in the Western world with the Southern Hemisphere is typically we want it to be and power imbalance.
Yes. I think it's really sinister, but it's exactly what you're saying. And Rennie Edo-Lodge says it in her book as well. She's like, basically, white supremacists are scared of black people taking over because it's that exact concept of, I say it so many times, but privilege, no, equality to the privileged feels like oppression. When they see a black man in a man of color in power, people feel oppressed by it. White people feel like that's my space, but they're happy to go over and help in a country where they're like, oh, this is where you belong. I'm not saying these are my beliefs. I'm saying that's how dark those undertones are. Yeah. The problem is people aren't aware of it. That's the issue. They don't see that. They're like, I'm being helpful. I'm going to go help in Africa.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, hold really racist beliefs when they're in their own country. And it's because it's that very small level of, but I'm doing a charitable deed, that makes them believe that those racist undertones aren't there. It's so nuanced and it's so interweaved into day-to-day life. And because everything is whitewashed, like 95% of journalists are white, things that get reported are from a white point of view. So it's very easy.
The media, yes. The media is owned by, exactly.
Yeah. So that's where the problem is.
Absolutely. I think there's so many points to touch on there, but it's because I think we don't talk about it. We dance around, you're exactly right. We dance around what it actually is because we think, well, people are doing some good, right?
Yeah.
But one of the things we keep saying and we want to keep maintaining is that good intentions are not good enough, right? Just because you mean well, just like being white and in a friendship with a woman of color, or just a person of color in general, I can mean well, but I can commit a ton of microaggressions in a friendship.
Oh, for sure.
Whether it's getting my hair braided, whether it's appropriating language, whether it's touching her hair, whether it's saying, like calling, like talking down about the neighborhood she grew up in.
Yeah.
There's so many different layers to the way, like that's the whole notion of like, because you have a black partner, or because you have a black friend, or because you have a biracial child, it does not mean you're not racist. In fact, some of the people I have met that are the most racist have children and have partnered with people of color.
Yeah.
And they use their privilege and they use that in a very real way in that dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I've been part of that problem. I've been a part of that problem. It's that level of racism where we can't, because we can't see you as equal, because we can't see whether it's Black Americans, whether it's people in East Africa, whether it's people in Cambodia or South America, to see you as truly and fully equal, there's a lot of things that would not be happening in development work, right? Because there's a pay gap as wide as 900% in the development sector, where me as a white person with my master's degree could go work for the UN or work for Save the Children or work for Comic Relief or any of these organizations. And I could get paid up to 900% more than someone just as, if not more qualified in their country of origin.
Yeah.
Like, how insane is that? I should be paid less, if anything, because I'm not from the country. And I don't know what to call it other than colonialism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't. So, yeah.
I think I think that the powers at play is, I think what you're saying about charity at home is really interesting, because I think part of the problem is until you start addressing the inequalities and the discrepancies within your own like country, whether that be looking at the gender pay gap between men and women or looking at microaggressions like you talk about within racism, I think when you start to see the nuances in your own country, then you might have a better understanding to think about why it wouldn't be appropriate for you to go and volunteer in a certain place or why it wouldn't be appropriate for you to do something. But if you're completely unaware, if you're completely blinded by your privilege in your own country, it's going to be very difficult for you to understand why this is a negative. And it is a really uncomfortable process being faced with the fact that some of the choices you've made in your life will have oppressed other people and some of the language you've used will have been very degrading and rude. And even when I was younger, I talked to lots of my friends who are women of color or mixed race, and they would even say, because they were brought up in a very white setting, they were like, we didn't even realize that we were being racist to ourselves and to other women of color. Mm-hmm. We were just so conditioned to not know, and actually
whitewashed.
Yeah. And addressing it like retrospectively is kind of weird. So I have a mixed race friend, she's like, I didn't even really realize that I was black or that I was mixed. And that's really problematic in itself, because she just didn't know until she kind of went out into the world. And then she was like, "What? Why am I not the same?" You know, it's like you say, your brother's raising like a mixed child, and I think it's such a big deal that we talk about, especially in Britain. I think there's a massive like prudish nature towards talking about anything, but you need to talk about it. We need to talk about the fact that racism is very real. It does exist. Like you see these tweets on Twitter where white people are like, "Oh my God, racism doesn't exist in this area in America because there's a multicultural march." Have you seen this stuff? And it's like people genuinely believe that it's not there. But racism doesn't have to be someone using a word that's really rude. Racism can be, as you say, like asking someone, "Why are you having that for breakfast? That's weird." And it's like, it's not weird. It's that's their culture. Or why are you wearing that? Or why is your hair like this? Those questions are microaggressions because you're trying to put yourself as the person of privilege as the setting standard or as the norm, and everyone else is the other. But that's not.
And actually, touching on that, all these liberal, my experience here in the US, where you have the liberal cities like Portland, Oregon, or it's a facade.
Really?
It is a facade. Even within the white liberal movement, there's microaggressions and have racist undertones that they're not even aware of sometimes, or if they are, they refuse to acknowledge them. And so it's deeply rooted. So those ideas of even within a multicultural city, they are still segregated within yes. that. You know, so you'll go, whether it's Boston, Portland, Seattle, you know, anyway, just like if you go to Leeds, you know, Birmingham, you know, London, you know, Manchester, you'll see it. It's you might be multicultural, but you're in your segregated spaces.
Yes.
And so it's a facade in general that there's this whole, kumbaya, there's multiculturalism. I think young people are showing that more than people our generation. You know, I think the promise or the hope is in what we see with young people, because they not only see who they are, but they're also challenging how we identify them.
For sure.
In terms of how they view themselves, even gender-wise and so forth. But that's, so there's a facade in that. And so it's interesting. Those images go out there and people think, you see people marching and everything. But they have to do the work. I can call myself a feminist, but I have to continually do the work to unlearn all the male chauvinist, patriarchal aspects that has been taught to me since birth.
Right.
So I could claim to be an ally to women and other genders and the LGBTQIA community, but I can still continue to do and say things, whether I'm aware or not, that can be aggressive and prejudicial.
Yeah.
So it's recognizing that aspect. And a lot of white liberals that claim to be allies of the movement of breaking the system of racism and so forth tend to not see do that self-reflection.
Yeah.
And that might be harsh for me to say this, but it is what I've witnessed. And it's acknowledging that and doing the work is what needs to, that's the other,
I completely agree. I think the biggest fight, I genuinely think it's over the language. I think people are so scared to be thought of as racist, to be seen as racist, that they can't even sit there and acknowledge, like, actually, maybe that was a racist thought, or maybe that was, I think that being true to yourself and just seeing it is the best step forward. But I think people find it so affronting that they actually can't, they're just like, no, everything's fine. Because once you start to dismantle your understanding of the world, you see the cracks in everything. I started to realize how many racist thoughts, not like outwardly racist, but just things I would think, presumptions I would have about a person of color, or presumptions I would have against a certain race. That isn't me being like, oh my God, I hate that person. It's just I've been conditioned to believe a racist idea. And I think being able to have that awareness and go, I'm going to change that. Because once you can see it, you can change it. But I think if you can't see it, you can't change it. And most people aren't willing or aren't ready to be like, actually, I have played a part in propping up a structure that is wholly unfair.
Yep. I think that's so necessary to talk about. I think one of the biggest things that jumps out in that conversation, so humility. Mm. We just say that humility is, I think if I could study that, if I could write a thesis and do a PhD on the, on what is missing for people who are not willing to see their role, whether, again, whether it's misogyny, whether it's white supremacy and racism, whether it's the white savior complex, you know, more specifically in the Southern Hemisphere, I think humility is what separates, right? Because we talk about ignorance, right? I think that's a cop out, because we, in this day and age, everyone, we have access to this information.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think there is truth. There are some levels of ignorance there, but I think even more so, it's the level of humility, right? Is to say, hey, I have messed up.
Mm.
And I think that one of the biggest ways we can help encourage a change in that, whether, you know, not just for our generation, but for generations above and below us, is talking about it openly. Like, I think one of the worst things I can do, or anyone in this work can do, is to talk about it as if we're removed from the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So we need to be able to, before anything else, mm-hmm. be able to say, no, I'm not going to point the finger outward until I look at myself.
Yeah.
And not, you know, look at myself and that, now I'm good. You know, I'm doing no, ongoing.
Yeah.
as I'm challenging these other organizations, in my mind, as I'm coming back to Uganda in a few weeks, what is that? And I'm going to be visiting a friend's project in Tanzania. What does it look like? I've never been to Tanzania. What does that look like to enter a new community and enter, you know, meeting with another organization of folks? Am I coming in to learn? Am I coming in as a student, or am I coming in to impose what I think I know and what I think I'm an expert on? And so that's just kind of a little, you know, added part of this ongoing conversation, is that I never want it to be portrayed that I think I've figured it all out.
Yeah.
I know that I can perpetuate problems now still, but I want to be held accountable and I want to be challenged. And I think that comes from a place of humility.
Yeah.
So I think if I had anything I would want the listeners to this episode to take away, is that we're not saying don't go, don't travel, don't volunteer. We're saying, like, approach it. If you can't approach it with humility and with the understanding that as if you are white, or you are even a person of color coming from a privileged context, that you can perpetuate really harmful narratives, you can perpetuate really harmful things, and by way of the white savior complex. So approach it with humility and a desire to minimize that potential harm.
I can go even further than that and say, start at home. You know, I think you know, before you even think about going anywhere else, look at your community, look from within first. Like, I think I would even say there should be a moratorium on people just going, you know, you have to look at, unless there's a special relationship that you gleaned from, you know, I think you have to look at home, you have to look at your community, where you can work, your spaces first, because there's an interesting tendency for a lot of those that do charity work, going to Africa and so forth, and ignore the disparities that exist in their own country.
Yes.
And ignore the racial, gender issue, and completely ignore, like, not pay attention to, and are complicit to the continuation of those disparities. And so, yes, you might want to, yes, I want to go to Vanuatu and volunteer. You can have that wish. But again, what are you, why? You know, it's better. I think the better thing is to go and visit and contribute to the economy as a tourist.
Yeah, that's so true.
And appreciate the culture from that perspective before you decide to want to, you know, take a backpack and $4,000 or whatever and head out to whatever country you think that needs your help.
Also, I guess, you know, fundamentally, if we work in our own countries to dismantle these ideas of racism and to platform people of color, people from different minority backgrounds, people with disability, people with different genders, all of these things, if we work to make those at the forefront, I think that is what's going to really help if other countries are in difficult situations or in conflict, lead by example. If we make it so that equality here is so steadfast and so credible and so real, I think that will give us a much better stead to be able to stand there and go, actually, you know what, I can help here, rather than not. Would you agree with that?
No, I agree. That's exactly what my, exactly that. Because that then gives you a really understanding of what it takes
to be
a community activist, to be, you know, someone who cares about humanity. And the other thing I was going to add on, another add on to that, is it should be an exchange system. If you want to go and volunteer in Uganda, then there should be someone from Uganda who comes and volunteers where you're from. It should be, so it's a cultural exchange, a cultural understanding of one, you know, so it's a cultural exchange.
It's not a power play. It's not a power play. It's you both have value to add to each place.
Exactly. So this person comes to your community and lives with your family and learns about the culture and systems of your community and volunteers somewhere as you do the same there. Yeah. That's how it should be. So it's not just a one-way traffic, because what also continues to perpetuate is that young African kids or Black kids or whatever, seeing all these white adults coming in and doing all this work, it creates this this awe in them, thinking, oh wow, you know. And that's, those are damaging.
So images. Damaging.
That's something I grew up with, because in Kenya, you know, in terms of what we watched growing up, it was British and American movies, TV, you know, programs and so forth. And it was, you know, very obviously white-centric, and even blonde, blue-eyed was the, you know, the number one thing that was played out. And so you see Barbie dolls and all of that stuff. So when you see those images, that's why you have people trying to lighten their skin all over, whether it's Southeast Asia, Africa, you know, lightening their skins, you know, trying to make their hair straight and all of that stuff, because of all these things that have been put.
And it also, I guess, it makes on the flip side, like, I bet a lot of people will be ignorant to the fact that Africa isn't just a sea of people who have nothing. There are people who are doctors, lawyers, have careers, intelligent. Like, it's only a small portion. I think the narrative is so pushed out there that, like, people in Africa are all starving, and Africa's fucking massive.
Nairobi, where I was born and raised, is now known as the Silicon Savannah, because it is a tech hub. There's over, I think, $3 or $4 billion worth of business going on in terms of the tech industry. They're so way ahead in terms of, you know, these startups, you know, 200 or 300 startups every year, I think. And, you know, this whole money transfer aspect actually came from Kenya.
Oh, wow.
We were doing this 10 years ago.
There we go. You know? There we go. Okay.
We were doing this 10 years ago. So there's innovation going on all over Africa.
Yeah.
There's so many brilliant kids, you know, people doing brilliant things the African way, that incorporates the African way and also gleans from technology and systems from other areas. And so this image of Africa being helpless and needing assistance, every place in the world needs assistance.
Exactly.
I see it here. UK, I am so sure.
You
will struggle. Everyone struggles. No one is... The idea, like, ask any middle-class person, are you happy with your financial situation? Do you feel secure in terms of how you're living? Do you think are you working extra just to make ends meet? And it's a universal yes. So it's those are the things, I could go on.
It's so true. And it's just, it's that whole message about misinformation and platforming and you're completely right. It's about trying to keep a certain hierarchy in play. And the problem with that is that it just self-perpetuates. The more people go out to help in Africa, the more these young children are thinking, why are they doing this? And then the people on Instagram think the whole of Africa, which is so redundant. Everyone's like, Africa, as if Africa is like one country. that's yes. like all the problems are just localized yeah, into like that big. Exactly. And it's weird because you even brought up on the idea that, oh, poor Africa. I don't know where that narrative started, who decided, well, we do, but I mean, it's just not taught. And that's, yeah.
I mean, I would, you know, what I would blame is, in some ways, it's the governments themselves yeah. that have, you know, that create this narrative in what they teach in schools and school curriculums. And, you know, and when you're a person of privilege that goes to visit a different country, you tend to be more. And when I'm saying person of privilege, I'm talking in terms of wealth. I'm
yes.
not necessarily talking. So if you're, you know, generally, a lot of people who visit are upper middle class to rich.
Oh, for sure.
And so
yeah.
that in itself creates that, you know,
huge disparity.
Disparity. And so, and it's actually, you see the same in the reverse. Like a lot of students or a lot of people who visit the UK or from Africa, are people of privilege.
Yeah.
You know, do very well for themselves. And so, so you have this, you know, you're above, you know, like someone visiting Africa, you know, has that mentality already. And then the funny thing is they'll go straight to the poorest areas.
Yes.
Because they'll skip Nairobi. No, I'm not going to, you know, but I'm going to take pictures of, you know, kids who are poor. And, you know, it's a very interesting,
it's
a
very well played signaling. Isn't it? I guess
yes.
it's like the real.
Yes.
Can I say something to that? Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead. No, I'm done. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
So one of the things I wanted to say to that, which is an excellent point, and I hope I am not repeating anything, is that you think about like, okay, are you familiar with what I mean? Confirmatory bias.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so confirmatory bias is the things that we store in our memory and in our knowledge bank of certain things. So, right. So let's use the example of all the mass shootings that happen in the US mostly are by white men.
Yes.
But we don't store that white men are terrorists, or we don't store in our memory bank that like when a white man is crossing the street in normal business attire, that I should be more terrified of him than a black man,
yes.
honestly, because who's more likely to commit a mass shooting where I'm going to be?
So true.
But that's so confirmatory bias is what do we store in our memory about that group of people, whether it is Muslim people. So we have tons of confirmatory bias issues with the Muslim population. We have tons of confirmatory bias when it comes to trans women.
Yeah.
There's tons of confirmatory bias issues when it comes to Africa. And so, you know, we have like there's a section in my city called Kensington. Where there's documentaries and things about it because it's so messed up on heroin. The whole area is like people, like kids that I've worked as the juvenile justice social worker and kids that are from the community, like Black and Latinx children, like youth, 15, 16 years old, they refer to their own neighborhood as zombie land because
oh, wow.
there's been such an influx of the opioid epidemic. And it's largely people not even from that neighborhood coming in, living in like, tent cities.
Yeah.
And so you look at that and I think devastating, horrible. They need help. They need all the charity in the world too, right? But when you think of America, you don't think of Kensington.
No.
When you think of, you know what I mean? So like there's poverty, there's, you know, sadness, there's brokenness in all parts of the world. Like that's a big theme of this conversation today. But
yeah.
one of the most damaging things is that within the conversation around confirmatory bias is that it's not what we're storing as the overarching narrative.
Yeah. I think so, what's so damaging is, and this could be a whole other podcast, but it's when it's like, so it's a white man, father accidentally shoots daughter or something, or like father accidentally something. And then it'll be like, if it's a black man, it's like black man kills and it'll be, he actually didn't, but it's the headline, it's the newspapers, it's all of those things. And I think we are becoming, to use the word, more woke. I think that social media, and I think right younger generations are being so like calling people up on this because the people in power, especially in the media, tend to be older, white, middle-class men who control it. But the people taking in the media now, the younger people aren't like, they're like, no, this is bullshit. But that's still such a small echelon of society that's using Twitter, that's talking about these problems. And it's like, this is the other issue, like people who are engaging with it, if you are from a, like a lower socioeconomic background, like are you able to interact with information that's telling you that actually a lot of the stuff you're getting fed for free in the news isn't actually that true? This is the other, there's so many nuances to how we view the world, you know, like people who listen to my podcast most likely are going to be from quite a good socioeconomic background, probably will be quite educated, already have the access to these tools and are learning further. And it's once you see that, then you're like, God, this is a whole massive world out there that we're just, I don't even know how you tap into it, you know?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I think that in activism, anti-racism, activism, all of that is, there's a lot of issue with like classism and accessibility. And that's one of the things I've really noticed is that like a lot of, whether it's whether it's like women in Uganda that are living in a slum or the village, or it's women in Philly living in public housing and working their hearts off to just make ends meet with their three children. And like, where are their voices in feminism, right? Yes. When we talk about intersectional feminism or anti-racism, where are their voices?
Yes.
Because really these systems that are oppressing are actually affecting them more than anyone else.
Yeah.
And so often the people who need to be heard the most, not that they're not voiceless, like I think we brought this up, they're not, they have voice and they have very powerful things to say when given the opportunity, but where is their seat at
the table? They don't have a platform, that's the thing. So this is my issue, like the other thing, sorry, I've been talking for ages, the last thing I kind of want to touch on, just it's from a personal question point of view. So like, I was saying to Bruce that I interviewed two women who are both lesbian refugees from Cameroon who are trying to come over here and seek asylum, but it's really hard to on the grounds of sexuality. And my kind of angle with things now is trying to platform people and give them a voice, but how much of that has got white savior complex, or how do we, because the sad truth of a lot of things is as a white woman, I can platform shit that other people can't platform, you know? So I know that I can get to a place that a woman of color probably couldn't in certain industries. Mm-hmm. So how do I use that to help other people? So like give them a voice, but how do I do that without it turning into like, kind of like I'm doing good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That's always a learning process, I think, in terms of where does you wanting to help then not turn into the savior complex aspect. And I think part of that would be to challenge the systems themselves. So if you have these conversations in places that where you see, if you work in an office that's all white, it's going into a meeting and say, why isn't there diversity in our, why aren't we being diverse? Or why aren't we recruiting from a diverse population? Yes. You know, it's like those are the things you can do on the flip side, because it's one thing to be helpful to someone who is in need of help, but then are you also confronting or challenging the systems that are causing that disparity? Yes. So I think, so that's what I'm saying. So like if it's an organization that you work in or you want to use to aid someone, look at the organization itself. Is it operating from a place of inclusivity?
Yeah.
You know, that's how I would see it. So again, for me, if I want to be an ally for women or an ally for the LGBTQIA community or an ally for, you know, immigrant populations, if I'm in a space where, like even this conversation we're having, I'm in spaces where it's majority white or whatever, majority male, and it comes and we're having just a candid conversation, I will bring those conversations up. If someone says something off kilter, I will confront
them up.
As you know, because we tend to, you know, it's fearful, it's scary not to. I mean, it's scary too. And I mean, in the past, I was scared to. You know, I had all these thoughts and feelings about how I hated all this disparity that I was seeing, but I was trying to be the good black guy, you know, the safe black man. And I had to let go of those layers. I had to, All it does is you become complicit.
That's
become
the thing.
Part of the system.
That's the level of racism that people often are at, that they can't see it because they're inherently good people. They don't want for anything bad to happen, but it's that fear of being like, oh my God, because that even happened to me when I went on the No White Saviors page. I was like, oh my God, I've done this. I didn't even know that. And you have to be like, shit, I need to address this behavior and see it. And that's like, I see it all the time. I think it's that first step to being towards like, you're never going to be, and like, if you feel comfortable, it's probably because someone else is suffering, I think, is usually how it works.
Exactly. It's the balance between always recognizing that there's an imbalance and you can't be completely comfortable when that imbalance exists. And then at the same time, giving yourself space to regenerate and rejuvenate so that you can challenge those disparities.
Yeah.
So you're never comfortable. Don't allow yourself to be comfortable, but also give yourself space to internalize and rejuvenate so that, because sometimes if you're always just fighting, then you will exhaust yourself.
Yeah,
but you
exactly.
have to, there's a balance, you know, you have to find that balance between taking time for yourself and rejuvenate. But then when you go back in, always recognize, if I'm comfortable, someone else is uncomfortable. How can I change?
And I think sometimes what happens is we get this massive feeling of guilt. Guilt's never useful. I think that's something we need to talk about. Like, don't feel guilty, just do something. So instead of feeling like, oh, I've realized all this stuff and now I feel really bad about it, there's no point like ruminating and feeling bad. Just try and change it. Because I think I just felt guilty for ages and I thought that in of itself was helpful. It's not, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's...
Yes.
That's so important. I think, I don't think guilt or shame... is productive beyond that initial, beyond initial, like, it's just going to like paralyze you. And I hear a lot of people talk about this and I can relate to an extent. But there's so much work that needs to be done in challenging, like Bruce has so much work to do in challenging other men about like misogyny. Right. And the patriarchy, like he has so much work to do in that. And you and I as white women have so much work to do in challenging fellow white women and white men.
Also in ourselves, challenge,
That's the biggest challenge. I think the first challenge is yourself, for sure.
Yeah.
Not trying to live in the guilt and shame and realizing like that's kind of counterproductive, but realizing that once you acknowledge it and are able to start educating yourself and understanding and asking for accountability, that is where the real growth is going to happen. I think also looking at motivation, I know Bruce has talked about just motivation and everything. And I think Bruce and I were talking about the quote from, Bruce, do you have your phone out? Could you find that quote by Joyce Banda?
Yes.
It's on the No White Saviors timeline. I don't know if you saw the article we posted about when Madonna went to Malawi and was basically demanding that Joyce Banda like pay her attention.
No, I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, it's really good.
So you post it? Oh, yes. Okay, here it is. Okay. It says, kindness, as far as its ordinary meaning is concerned, is free and anonymous. If it can't be free and anonymous, it is not kindness. It is something else. Blackmail is the closest it becomes.
Yeah.
So basically, yes. So if it's not free and anonymous and you want to project that kindness and it be known, then what you're doing is coercion.
Yeah, it's what so you're doing true.
You want something for the actions that you are doing.
Yeah.
And so it changes completely from a selfless act or selfful act into a transaction.
Not to go like too deep, but the other problem with this is it's because of the rise of social media and because innately, I'm reading a really good book at the minute about how our desire to experience things has changed so much that we don't even want to experience them. We experience sharing them. So we don't even experience things anymore. We experience how people respond to us sharing them online. So the other problem, like the other nuanced section is like, some people might actually be inclined, but it's so in our nature now to share stuff that it's almost like you can't get away from it.
Yeah,
but that's a whole other problem.
Let me say it so that, because I want to acknowledge her, former president of Malawi, Joyce Banda. Kindness, as far as its ordinary meaning is concerned, is free and anonymous. If it can't be free and anonymous, it is not kindness. It is something else. blackmail is the closest it becomes.
Yeah, it's so true.
So,
yeah.
So good. And it's so neat. I mean, yeah, I think that, again, I think we could do a whole episode on the influence of social media on and social good, because I think there's actually someone who's doing research in the UK right now around the, like, I think they're trying to focus on the good that social media does. And I really do think there can be a lot of good. It can be harnessed to do a lot of good, but it can also obviously, like we're seeing, do a lot of harm. And I don't think there's been as much conversation as there has been about the white savior complex. I don't know if we really understand the gravity of how much social media, like blogs, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, how much those sites and platforms have really encouraged more of it, and even more irresponsibility. Like, I think that maybe before, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there maybe were people that were more equipped, or at least not as frequently seeing, you know, 18, 19 year olds going and starting NGOs. And it's, I don't really have words. I literally lose words when I think about the way that this has all been so normalized. So I think we haven't really seen, you know, just to finish that thought, we haven't seen or understood the gravity of what social media has really done.
For sure. It's definitely amplified. I mean, with so many things, I think it's such a double-edged sword, because I see so many merits, but so many pitfalls with it. It's just, as you say, I could literally talk about it all day. So to finish off, like, this conversation that we've been having, the main takeaway really isn't to be affronted or feel like you're doing anything wrong or feel like this is an attack. I think what we need to do is shift our understanding of the way that we look at the world. And that starts with just trying to see who you are in a society and how the society profits off that, and follow accounts like No White Saviors, Rachel Cargill. Is it Cargill? Cargill?
Cargill. I think it's Cargill. Yeah.
And then I'm going to link some other, you guys below and then anyone else. But did you guys have anything that you think is a really good, like, takeaway message for someone who's been listening?
Chelsea, go.
If I could have another thing that I feel like I would really love people to walk away with, is that if you wouldn't do it in your own country, please don't do it in another person's culture, in another person's country. So if you wouldn't start that, if you wouldn't have been able to start that charity at 18 years old, or start, you know, volunteering in that position at whatever age in your own country, in your own city, in your own context, then please don't do it abroad, because what you're doing is you're saying that people in another country, in especially, you know, whether it's East Africa or another region in the Southern Hemisphere, what you're saying is that people there deserve a lower standard than what you would provide in your own country. And that's not fair. That's not ethical. And it's just plain wrong. So really go into the mindset of, when you're trying to assess if you volunteer abroad or work abroad, would you be able to fill that role in your own country of origin?
Yes. So, that's such a good idea. Yeah. Love that. Bruce, any parting words?
Wow. Unpacked so much. I think, do self-examination, ask yourself about your motivations for wanting to do this, if you are looking to volunteer, and look within your community and the people around you and the immigrant community that's in your city, town, region, country. If you want to learn about other people and other cultures, and study about the white savior complex, patriarchy, you know, systemic racism, you know, those things are really important, you know, white privilege. Those are things you have to look at before you do anything, you think about anything to do with co-creative work, development work, community development work, not charity. Eliminate charity from your vocabulary as well.
Yeah. That's so good. I'm going to do that. I love that.
Yeah.
No, to be fair, though, I have to say that people, my friends from the UK, you guys use that word a lot more than we do.
Yeah.
I feel like everything related to, like, social good is, like, I don't think I've heard Americans ever use charity as much as I hear you guys use
it. Yeah, it's a very used word.
So that might be part of the
the work, right?
Yeah.
It's challenging that word.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely do think, because I do find it degrading sometimes, as I say, it doesn't quite sit right. Because it should, you know, like it's not, because also when you say like, oh, you're just doing me charity, it can be degrading when you're using it in like a colloquial sense with your friends. So why it's not seen that?
I think it's in itself, even colloquially or whatever, it still is a depowering.
Yeah, that's what it means. Yes,
yeah, I think it is, you know, it's like a pity.
Yeah, exactly. You're right.
It's a pity system. You know, I'm doing charity work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
You're so right. Language is literally so powerful.
Sorry.
No, you can't.
I was just gonna say, I feel like I've heard charity used by people in the UK as more of like a noun than an adjective. Or I mean than an action. Than a verb. The charity.
Yes. Right?
Rather than the nonprofit or the
We use charity as the word for nonprofit. So every organization that's helping is called a charity.
Right.
Yeah.
So I feel like both of those could be addressed.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I don't have anything. I'm good. I would love to stay on the call longer.
I know.
I'm terrified the house might fall down.
Thank you so much. I know we've been talking for ages, but I've absolutely loved it.
I have too. Awesome.
But thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. See you guys.
Bye.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.